From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Trump administration is warning today that all sides should refrain from violence as protests in Hong Kong cause traffic to grind to a halt at one of the world's busiest airports. The sound of thousands of protesters angry about alleged police brutality over the weekend. They occupied the main terminal at the city's international airport. And that disruption forced airport officials to cancel all of the day's remaining flights in Hong Kong and put more pressure on the local government to quell a protest movement that's been building for months. NPR's Anthony Kuhn joins us from the airport. Anthony, what is the scene like there at this point?
The scene is peaceful. The arrival and departure areas of the airports are just completely packed with young protesters in black. They've got signs and posters and pictures hanging all over the place. There are also still quite a lot of foreign travelers stranded here from all over the world. This is one of the world's busiest airports. About mid-afternoon, news came through that authorities were canceling all flights. By the time I got here, those canceled flights now said delayed, so it hasn't completely been shut down. Now, protesters have been here for about 4 days trying to explain what they are doing to travelers from around the world. And the protests were sort of winding down, but then this weekend there were very violent clashes between protesters and police in the city, a lot of allegations of police brutality, and people came back to these protests at the airport in anger.
Well, and actually, let's take a listen here because we have some sound of the police in Hong Kong clashing with demonstrators at a subway station there on Sunday. So that was elsewhere in the city. What has the police response been so far at the airport?
Well, when it was announced that all flights were being canceled, people were afraid that this was a prelude to a violent police sweep. Riot police would come in here with batons and tear gas. So a lot of people left the airport. The public transport system was overloaded. But things quieted down. And now a lot of protesters have come back.
Anthony, everybody is wondering how far Beijing is willing to go to stop these protests. And there's a report that the Chinese military is building up troops and conducting drills in the city of Shenzhen along the border with Hong Kong. What do you make of that?
Well, my sense is that so far, the Hong Kong police seem to be able to handle things. Now, what's been happening over the past couple of days is that the protesters use these sort of flash mob tactics. They barricade and block off the streets. They sometimes throw rocks and Molotov cocktails at the police. Then the police come in charge. They beat a lot of people, and they arrest some. And then the rest of the protesters go on to the next neighborhood, and this repeats and repeats and repeats. So the police are able to clear the streets, get traffic moving. So I think that the Chinese have been showing their commitment, their willingness to use as much force as necessary. But I don't think anyone feels that the Hong Kong police have totally lost control of the situation here yet.
Well, and in the back of a lot of people's mind is Tiananmen Square back in 1989 when the government cracked down on a protest and left hundreds to maybe even thousands of demonstrators dead. Is anything like that a possibility here? We saw the Senate Majority Leader in the U.S., Mitch McConnell, say today that any kind of crackdown would be totally unacceptable on the part of China.
Well, you know, Jeremy, that's a comparison that you have to make. You know, after Tiananmen, China was isolated. Their economy went into a tailspin. It was a disaster for the country. Remember that Tiananmen was an army crackdown. You had tanks and armored personnel carriers and, you know, automatic weapons. China did not have enough properly trained and equipped riot police at that time, and they were not good at using sort of what you might call less than lethal force. Now they put more money into their, you know, internal security services than they do into their military. So they are very well equipped with state-of-the-art water cannons and, you know, surveillance devices. So it's highly unlikely that there could be a repeat of Tiananmen. And of course, as I said, it would also be a political and economic disaster for their reputation and for Hong Kong.
And just before we let you go, Anthony, I'm hearing a little more noise in the background there. What's happening?
Well, morale among the protesters here is very high. Some of them feel that they've scored points by taking control of the airport. And there have been cheers going up calling for a revolution and for Hong Kong to be revived. It's a very high-energy scene right here.
That is NPR's Anthony Kuhn at the airport in Hong Kong. Anthony, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Well, let's go to El Paso now, where some students are back for their first day of school for the new year at a very tender time. Many new people who were at the Walmart massacre a week ago, many knew someone who died there, including the youngest victim, 15-year-old Javier Rodriguez, a student at Horizon High School. At a memorial at that school last week, the school superintendent, Juan Martinez, went off script.
Javier did not deserve this. We are people of light. We are people of hope. And we hope, truly and sincerely and with all my heart, that this will never, ever again repeat again anywhere in any school in this country. No, not our children. Stop taking them away from us.
School Superintendent Juan Martinez. Adrian Barrios is a social studies teacher at Ricardo Estrada Middle School in El Paso. His kids have been back in school for 2 weeks. He taught Javier in 7th and 8th grade, also spoke about him at that vigil. Adrian, that must have been so difficult. How are you doing?
Robin, I'm doing better. You're absolutely correct. It was probably one of the hardest things you'd have to do. I mean, as a teacher, you never think that, you know, you're going to have to speak at a memorial of one of your students and to kind of wrap our minds around the idea that he's not with us anymore. It was a difficult time.
Can you try to tell us, because all young people have light, but Javier seemed to have, you know, extra light.
The thing about Javier was, you know, and it's not very common, you know, I'm a father of a teenager also, but Javier was always smiling. I never saw Javier upset. I never saw Javier angry. He was just so full of life, and you could tell his passions because he wore it on his sleeve. He always had a soccer ball with him, and he was just a fantastic young man.
Yeah. So there's going to be a shadow in the high school where he would have been. But you've been back to school with your kids, and they're younger, a little younger, for a week now. How did you address this?
Well, the whole first couple of weeks back were, you know, the students were happy. The students, you know, were eager. And then that weekend hit, and you could tell the tone had changed. You know, when the students came back, they were scared. They were angry, and they felt all the emotions that it was okay for them to feel. And some of them wanted to talk. Some of them just wanted to go to the counselors. Some of them were crying because, you know, Horizon is a small community. And a lot of my students were either good friends with Javier or even, you know, related to him. And so we all felt it. And you could tell it was somber when we came back from that weekend.
Well, it's not just that this horrible attack happened. It's someone who drove, we now have confirmed, over 10 hours to target and kill Mexicans. They must know that. What do you say to them? How do you get their minds back on the schoolwork? Or I'm wondering if the opposite is true. You know, we had the bombing in the Boston area where we are, and there were some kids who just desperately wanted to immerse themselves in other things to forget about. You know, some kids can't, some kids want to forget.
It was a combination of both, Robin. I'd say that a lot of the students that came in the classroom seemed to want to talk about it. They didn't understand motives. They didn't understand why. And they definitely didn't understand that a young man like Javier was taken for really no reason at all.
Yeah. Well, you are a social studies teacher. And
is
this in your curriculum, white supremacy, hatred?
Not in my curriculum. I mean, they don't really start talking about instances in history where there is genocide, such as World War II or things like that until they get into the high school.
Well, and by then they will have lived it.
Right.
Yeah. And as you said, your kids have been back for a week, Adrian. Has it changed at all, or is this going to take? I mean, how much time do you think this will take?
I don't think there's a set answer to how much time it's going to take. I think everybody's different, and I'm very proud of our community. Our community's healing very well, and it just gives me a source of inner strength seeing all the community come together and, you know, specifically remembering Javier to stand united that, you know, this is not indicative of our community. It's, you know, we're strong. We're going to overcome. Mm. But it really puts things in perspective.
Adrian Barrios, a teacher at Ricardo Estrada Middle School in El Paso, remembering his former student, Javier Rodriguez. Adrian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
An elderly man in Washington State killed himself and his wife because they didn't have enough money to pay their medical debt, according to the Whatcom County Sheriff's Office. Nearly 80 million Americans carry medical debt, which contributes to 50% of American bankruptcies and, as you just heard, worse. 42%, almost half of the 9.5 million people diagnosed with cancer between 2000 and 2012, depleted their assets within 2 years. We're reminded of all of this in a New Yorker piece by Nathan Heller on the promise and pitfalls of GoFundMe, which crowdsources financial aid, a third of which is medical expenses. But GoFundMe is hit or miss. Our next guests think they have an alternative. They are former collection industry executives who decided to use their expertise to forgive medical debt instead of collecting it. And so far, their company, RIP Medical Debt, has abolished hundreds of millions of dollars in debt. They want to reach $1 billion by 2020. Co-founders Craig Antico and Jerry Ashton join us now. And Craig, we read this started when you were contacted by Occupy Wall Street. They were trying to raise $50,000 to buy people's debt. And you had a light bulb moment.
Well, the light bulb was that we noticed that their website was no longer accepting donations. And we said, wow, it looked like they were doing a tremendous job. It looked like they abolished over $30 million of debt, whether it was medical and student loans. But that left us saying, hey, we're the only ones that really could decide to go and abolish medical debt. Why don't we go do it? Yeah. We can't let this just die.
And now explain what we mean when we say medical debt. This is debt that's moved already to, well, creditors, you know, people who are trying to get the money. And then they also sell it to agencies which try to turn a profit through collecting the debt. In other words, if they can get just some of it, they give some of the money to themselves. Have I got that right?
You need to understand the life cycle of a medical bill. If you're unfortunate enough to get sick or hurt and you go to a hospital, automatically you start creating a bill. If you don't respond to that for whatever reason, then the hospital is forced to consider using collection agencies. Now, collection agencies work on a contingency. That means that they are assigned the accounts and they are guaranteed a percentage if they're able to recover it. Well, that can go on for two or three agencies for many hospitals until at some point in time the agencies will come back and say, these people are not responding. That's when the idea of debt purchasing comes into that world.
Well, to be clear, as you've explained, Jerry, this is after creditors have tried to get people to pay. Most of the time it's like blood from a stone. They can't. And the hospitals or, you know, whoever the providers are might then sell this debt to these other collectors?
Yeah, let me explain how it works. There's only about one collector for every 8,000 accounts at a hospital. There's $75 billion of medical debt that's in collection and on people's credit reports. So think of a hospital. They have $100 million of debt that they can't collect. They've gone through their 3 to 6 collection agencies over, say, 2 years. And a company comes to them and says, I'm willing to pay you 5%. And you've got to say, well, what are the chances of me collecting on that? It's an amazing windfall for them to get cash on accounts that have already been through 4, 5, 6 collection agencies. That's where the debt buyer comes in and why they're so valuable. Initially, what we did was we went to those debt buyers and we said to them, instead of collecting on these accounts that are 2 years, 3 years old when you get them, and you might have to collect on them for 5, 6, 7 years to make your return on your money, why don't we pay you for them? And we're only paying for the accounts that really are the ones that are in hardship. You know, are they spending more than 5% of their gross income? We'll abolish it. Or if they're making less than 2 times the federal poverty level, they'll qualify, amongst also being technically insolvent, which means that they have more debt than they have assets. Those are the three main criteria that we use to abolish the debt.
Well, so you buy this debt with money that you've raised, and then you turn around and instead of trying to collect the debt that you've bought, your goal is to cancel that debt.
Our only goal is to see that that debt is taken off the backs of our fellow Americans. Our only goal is to see that if there's a credit mark against them for that medical debt, that that is taken off their credit report. Our only goal is to see that that debt disappears.
Yeah, we put it into our debt cemetery.
We carry this RIP thing out a little bit too far.
Okay, well, look, let's just explain, too, is because it was so inexpensive. I mean, some people might say, wow, $5 million to get $100 million worth of debt. That's no small change, but it is relatively inexpensive. You say you can wipe out $1 million worth of debt with $10,000. I mean, at this point,
that is
it's
correct.
Reduced and so much.
This is the exciting part, if I can intrude here. Yeah. Because the price point is so reasonable and the deliciousness of someone who wants to help someone else, to get that kind of bang for the buck is unbelievable. Every dollar is worth $100. Every $10 is worth $1,000.
Interestingly, we are about to abolish our 800 millionth dollar of debt. So we will be abolishing our billionth dollar probably within the next 2 months. That's for over 300,000 people.
Ahead of your goal of 2020. And just to have be a little more specific here. So, for instance, you had two families that had Kentucky ties who wanted to help abolish debt in Appalachia. And they did, about $8 million worth. How much did they donate to abolish $8 million worth of debt?
Yeah, one couple gave $80,000. And another couple gave $20,000.
And wiped out $8 million in debt.
$8 million in debt. Our program costs are actually the data that we add to find out whether they qualify. It's the letters that we send. We send out yellow envelopes that tell people that their debt's been abolished. It's a surprising letter because it's a random act of kindness. They had no idea that they were getting this letter. We also have a team of people that go out to hospitals and debt buyers and actually work on getting debt.
But how do you choose?
We choose by adding data. TransUnion Healthcare Systems and the main TransUnion have supported us because they want to use information for good. So we're like a predatory giver. And what they're doing is they're letting us know what's the simulated income of this family? How many people are in the family? What federal poverty level percentage are they at? Because we want to make sure that we're abolishing debt for people that are actually deserving.
Yeah.
And people don't know that when you go to a hospital, usually there's a financial assistance policy that actually will give the cost of that care for free if you make less than 2 times the poverty level, which actually is about 33% of this whole population.
This is the challenge that Americans face, is that either they don't understand how the hospital system works, and very few people do, not even people in the hospital as far as we can tell in some cases. But the education is insufficient to the challenges that are there. And frankly, you could walk in having a great job, perfect credit, lovely home, and 8 months later, you could qualify for charity.
It just sounds incredible. But just, you know, one question that was raised in the New Yorker article about GoFundMe and, you know, the kind of downside of this kind of crowdsourcing is that it frees the government from having to do something to fix the problem that is the problem in the first place, the fact that there is such huge medical debt.
Well, there are fingers pointed everywhere. Hospitals will point to insurance companies who will point to the providers, who will point to the pharmacies. Everyone wants to see that somebody else pays the bill. So we're just sweeping after the parade. We know that. We know that our work is very, very important, but it takes care of the people that are wounded and on the battlefield. We really do need to stop the wars, but at this moment, that's not where we're positioned.
Okay, so tell me, either you, Jerry Ashton, or Craig Antico, that yellow envelope goes out. It's like the old TV shows, you know, where people would get, there was a millionaire or something giving out money or something. Have you ever seen someone receive it?
I haven't seen anybody get it. And we felt that it was really an invasion of privacy to actually record them when they get the letter, like Ed McMahon coming to the front door with a yellow envelope. Because medical debt is a private thing, and so is debt.
Yeah, so really, when we do the work that we do and we know that that yellow envelope will arrive by surprise at somebody's homes, we don't expect to hear from them. Mm-hmm. Many times we know that when we do hear from them that tears came about, incredulity came about. Mm-hmm. People would call their neighbors or they would call the Better Business Bureau to find out if indeed we were real. So we know we're affecting people. And we're happy about doing that. And we're grateful to our donors because that makes that happen. Yeah. But there's one thing that I'd like to have Craig address, and that is the fact that we're studying this problem very, very carefully. And there's a team of four universities that are working together with us to do an economic impact study of what it means to take medical debt off of someone's back.
Yeah, the preliminary results are encouraging. And this is only the first step. They just got a $1 million grant to actually survey the people that have had their debt abolished and the control group. Right now, that's an economic impact study. Yeah. This is going to talk more about the mental and spiritual and emotional side of this horrible, destructive thing called medical debt.
Yeah. That's Jerry Ashton, Craig Antico, co-creators of the RIP Medical Debt Charity. They buy and forgive medical debt. They don't try to collect it, although they're former collectors. Jerry, Craig, thank you so much for speaking to us about it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
And here's another success. The Northwood Church in Mississippi donated $36,000, paid off $4 million in medical debt for 4,100 people in seven counties. We'll hook you up to RIP Medical Debt at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
Maybe you can catch a falling star tonight during the peak of the Perseid meteor shower. The Perseids happen every year in August, and many say it's the best meteor shower of the year. Joining us now by Skype is Kelly Beattie, senior editor at Sky and Telescope. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Jeremy.
So this meteor shower happens every single year. What causes it?
You know, it's very predictable because this time every year, Earth crosses the path of a comet called Swift-Tuttle. Now, the comet isn't anywhere near around, but all the little particles that are spread out on its orbit, we collide with those enter our atmosphere, burn up, and those are what we see as the Perseid meteors.
And are they visible all across the country as long as there are clear skies?
They certainly are. In fact, they're visible all around the world. And, you know, it's not just tonight. If it happens to be cloudy tonight, you can, you know, camp out tomorrow night as well, and there'll still be some.
I saw some meteors about a week ago. Now, that wasn't the peak, but it's still the Perseids. It was pretty cool to see them. However, Kelly, now we're getting to a almost full moon. Is that going to cut down the amount of meteors people can see?
It sure will. You know, the moon is our friend and our foe when it comes to observing. It's almost a full moon, and its light will just dazzle us and flood the night sky with moonlight that will wash out the fainter meteors. Now, you're still going to see some. You'll see the brightest ones, but those will be fewer, and so it just requires a little more patience.
What is the best time to get out there and look for these meteors?
You know, the Perseids are one of the most popular showers because, in part, they're visible almost after the beginning of nightfall. So here in the Northeast, You can see them as soon as it gets dark. A little bit farther south in the country, you'll have to wait till maybe 10 o'clock. But the peak will actually come later at night, after midnight. So if you can stay up late or get up really early tomorrow morning, you'll see more, because then we'll be more head-on to where those meteors are coming from.
Do you agree with others who say it's the best meteor shower of the year?
It is one of the top two or three, and it's certainly the most popular because it occurs in summertime here in the U.S. A lot of people are out. The temperatures are great, and if you can fend off the bugs, you know, it's generally a pleasant experience. So my advice is, find a spot that's reasonably dark. You know, you don't have to go out into the boonies, but get out of view of street lights and the moon itself if you can, and just look wherever in the sky it's darkest. There's no particular direction, and that's where you'll have the best Perseid hunting.
Okay, and if you are sitting there bored for a few minutes or 10 minutes and you don't see any, what else can you look for in the sky right now? Because there are some visible planets right now.
Yes, indeed. And tonight in particular, if that moon is in view, right next to it is a fairly bright star, and that is not a star, it's the planet Saturn. Hmm. Then over to the right of Saturn, closer to the sunset point, is a much brighter star, and that's the planet Jupiter. They're both gracing our evening skies throughout this summer, and if you've got a telescope, they're A1 targets.
Will we see the other planets at all this summer or in the coming months, like Venus or Mars?
Well, Venus will be with us later this year. Mars is unfortunately lost in the glow of sunlight. But you've got the two largest planets in our solar system in view, so I take advantage of those.
That is Kelly Beattie, senior editor at Sky and Telescope. And you can check out the Perseid meteor shower, which peaks tonight and tomorrow. Kelly, thanks as always.
A pleasure, Jeremy. Clear skies.
Iran's foreign minister today accused the United States of provoking conflict in the Persian Gulf region, calling it a tinderbox ready to blow up. Tensions have risen in the Gulf since the U.S. pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal and reimposed sanctions aimed at Iran's oil exports. After Iran seized a British tanker last month, the U.S. launched a military coalition to protect commercial shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. That's a crucial choke point between the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean that about one-fifth of the world's oil must pass through on its way to markets around the world. Joining us now is Sarah Vakhshuri. She's founder and president of SVB Energy International, a strategic energy consulting firm in Washington and Dubai. Welcome. And first of all, what are the rules governing oil shipping in the Strait of Hormuz? Who has control over what happens in those waters?
So the oil that passes through the Strait of Hormuz goes from most major producers of OPEC, Kuwait, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and UAE. And almost all of the LNG, liquid natural gas, liquefied natural gas that is produced by Qatar, the largest producers as of now, is passes through Strait of Hormuz. But the Strait of Hormuz is a very narrow choke point that is located between Iran and Oman, and practically is the territorial waters of Oman and Iran. But based on international law, they are binded to guarantee the safety of the passage of these vessels. They have to cooperate, and also they are in charge and responsible for the safety of these tankers, even though that they're in control of them.
So what happens when we have a conflict like we have a few times in recent weeks, which is that Iran seizes a vessel in the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, based on international law, nations can defend themselves or each other if they are under attack. So it has been decades now since the Iraq-Iran war that U.S. Navy fleets are in the Persian Gulf and responsible for securing the U.S. And other commercial vessels that are passing through the this passage and choke point. So practically, the international forces, mostly in the past decades, U.S., were trying to secure the passage of this commercial vessel.
But now it's reached sort of a new level here. The U.S. has been recruiting other countries to join a naval coalition after the U.S. accused Iran of sabotaging tankers there. How unusual is it to have this kind of thing, an international brigade of ships patrolling the strait?
Well, two things together is happening. One is that Iran previously, under different occasions, have been threatening to closing the Strait of Hormuz. This happened previously under nuclear sanctions and in different occasions in the past few decades. But now we see that this threat have been actualized, actually, and there have been incidents, there have been attacks against the tankers, both in the Persian Gulf and in the Gulf of Oman. So now there is a more serious need for securing the commercial tankers and vessels that are passing this through. On the other side, U.S. Dependency on the oil that is shipped through this choke point have been reduced significantly due to the increase of shale oil and gas production inside the U.S. So practically, we cannot expect the U.S. taxpayers to pay for the security of oil that is going to the Asian markets, let's say China, India, or Japan. So it makes perfect sense that U.S. would invite other countries to help and to contribute to securing the commercial vessels passing through this choke point.
You're saying that's because the U.S. doesn't rely on the Strait of Hormuz as much as it used to?
Of course. So for U.S. spending a significant amount of money to secure the flow of oil from this choke point unilaterally doesn't make any more sense. And also, if you look at it in a long-term strategic view, the oil is going mostly to the Asian markets. Mm-hmm. And I'm not suggesting that any incident in the Strait of Hormuz does not have an impact in U.S. and U.S. market. Obviously, would have impact on the prices, but it does not have a direct impact for the security of oil flow going to the United States and gas, obviously.
What do you think Iran's goal is here? Why ratchet up the tension in the Strait of Hormuz many, many times in recent memory?
Well, Iran is using its control over this strait, which is having a very critical role in the global oil supply, as a leverage to use it anytime that it's in a hard and tough situation. Under the nuclear sanction, Iran threatened that if it cannot export any oil, it's going to close the Strait of Hormuz. Obviously, Iran was still able to export oil under the nuclear sanctions. But this time, that U.S. administration is trying and aiming for zero Iran oil export, Iran is not really able to export significant amount of oil. So they try to threaten to close the Strait of Hormuz verbally for many different occasions when President Trump's administration announced the sanctions on Iran. But surprisingly, the market did not really react to Iran's threats. We didn't see any significant increase in the oil prices, mostly because, as I mentioned, we have major other producers this time in the market, including U.S. But by these little incidents that happened with regard to the British tanker, Iran showed a more aggressive way to give the signal to the market that all these threats should be taken seriously if Iran cannot export any oil or some of its tankers are seized around the world.
Do you think that there is fear on the part of some, and I'm talking about in particular Germany and France, who are not going to join the U.S.-led coalition in the Strait of Hormuz, because they say there would be a great danger of being sucked into a military mission? Is there a worry that these tensions could escalate and perhaps spark a war?
Obviously, because any warship that goes into this area, especially because it's very close to the territorial waters of Iran, Iran might see it as an act of war. Things might get more aggressive. And if there is any military intervention or reaction toward Iran, all these military vessels obviously would be involved in that war. So there are a lot of hesitations for joining this coalition, but we have already seen some nations joining this coalition. And we do not expect that they would leave these waters very soon.
Sarah Bakshuri, how long do you see this going on in the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, I mean, if we look at it from the flow of oil and long-term destinations that are going to receive this oil, we can have an indication that this coalition might go for a long time because, as I mentioned a decade ago, U.S. dependency was really high on the flow of oil from Strait of Hormuz. And any interruption of supply from this choke point would have a direct and significant impact on the U.S. energy security. But now the story is different. So what we think is that this coalition could go for a long time, and U.S. would want some of its allies to contribute for the security of oil flow from this choke point. As again, at the end of the day, it does not make sense for U.S. taxpayer to contribute for security of oil that goes to China. Obviously, having the U.S. military in Strait of Hormuz does not only serve for the benefit of U.S. energy security perspective. In the case that there is a need for increase of military support in this area for securing the flow of oil, it makes sense that U.S. invites other allies to join U.S. for contributing for security and safety of oil flow from this strait.
Just finally, for our listeners who are learning a lot right now about the Strait of Hormuz, why would you say it's important to Americans, to ordinary Americans, what's going on in this choke point so far away from us?
Well, as I said, about one-fifth of global oil supply and almost most of LNG supplies from Qatar are passing through the Strait of Hormuz. But if there is any interruption and the prices of oil increase significantly, then it's going to have impact on the domestic oil prices. In the U.S., obviously, the impact might not be as significant as it would be on the prices, let's say, in China or in India or Japan, but it still is going to have a price effect. On the other side is also U.S. allies, for instance, Japan, South Korea, or European countries that are receiving oil or gas from this region. Their energy security would be hurt significantly. So it's both political reasons and also could have a price impact on the U.S. energy market.
That is Sarah Vakshuri, who is founder and president of SVB Energy International. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's here and now. Water, a precious resource, is under a lot of pressure. There's not enough of it. So what to do? Well, that water running down your shower, sink, or washing machine drain could be reused. You may know it's called gray water, and it accounts for more than half of indoor water use. 21 states allow some kind of gray water reuse. Colorado joined that list in 2013 and hopes it could help with the growing demand on that state's water supply. But today, almost no one is utilizing gray water in Colorado, at least not legally. Colorado Public Radio's Michael Elizabeth Sackis explains.
There are two gray water systems that are legal in Colorado. The first one is called Laundry to Landscape. Avery Ellis installs them. He's an ecological landscaper, and at his home in the city of Longmont, he explains how it works.
All right, welcome to my washing machine.
On Ellis's washing machine, the hose that pumps out wastewater has been connected to a valve. One direction goes to the sewer.
If I'm doing a load with bleach or if my baby's got dirty diapers, I have total control to flip this valve right here. But today, it's beautiful out. It's 70 degrees. I got normal wear and tear on my clothes. So I flip this valve and out that water goes through my crawl space out to my landscape direct.
The water is pumped into an irrigation system that, by law, is buried 4 inches underground to keep it from pooling or spraying into the air. In Ellis's yard, it waters young fruit trees and shrubs. He says a system like this costs a few $100s to do yourself, or around $1,500 if you work with a professional.
This system is simple and affordable, and I really advocated for this as the law was getting adopted.
The second legal system is a bit more complicated and costly. Wastewater from a shower or sink is collected in a storage tank and is used for the landscape or to flush toilets. There's internal plumbing, and the water needs to be filtered and treated and can't be stored for more than 48 hours. Gray water reuse was legalized in Colorado in 2013 in hopes it would help save water. Officials say that by 2050, if nothing changes, the state will have at least a million more people than our water can supply. And climate change makes the future of Colorado water even more uncertain. The state's water plan recognizes gray water as one tool to help close the gap. Ellis was closely involved when the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment set the rules for using gray water systems. Cities and counties first have to adopt the regulation before residents or businesses can set up a system. So far, only three, including Denver, have done so. Ellis isn't happy with that.
it takes a little civil disobedience and a little public support to push these laws into local adoption.
For Ellis, his civil disobedience is living in Longmont with a gray water system where it isn't allowed. And he teaches and helps others how to install laundry to landscape without permits. Because so far, even in the places where it's been adopted, no one has applied for the required gray water permit. Kurt Dahl is the environmental health manager with Pitkin County, which included gray water in its zoning in 2018.
We've had a few interested parties, but I think due to the complication of the regulation, they didn't see the benefit.
Dahl says he'd like to see changes to the law since no one is really using it, like possibly expanding the types of systems that are legal. And he'd like the state to reassess whether all the requirements are truly necessary.
If we are able to loosen the regulation and still protect for public health, we'll probably drive some costs down and may help make it practical for folks to put systems in.
Castle Rock is the newest municipality to adopt gray water rules, but only in new construction. Retrofitting an old home or building isn't allowed. Mark Marlowe is the director of Castle Rock Utilities. He says it comes down to expense.
What it would mean is a lot of staff time to review what that individual homeowner wants to do. It would require a lot of inspection to verify that it's done right, because if it's done wrong, you could create a problem.
That's why some cities and counties are choosing not to take on gray water at all. Sybil Charvel is an associate engineering professor at Colorado State University. She's been involved in gray water research for nearly 20 years and also advised the state in writing the rules. She says she's disappointed to see all the growth and construction over the past 10 years that's failed to include planning for gray water.
We knew there was all this upcoming new development, and we saw that as just a huge opportunity. And unfortunately, that opportunity has really not been realized.
Charvel's research looks at what levels of treatment are necessary to make gray water safe. In Colorado's code, a system has to be certified by the National Sanitation Foundation. Charvel tried to fight it. She says the NSF's requirements are too strict.
We don't necessarily need to, you know, remove the constituents of shampoo to make sure water is safe to flush a toilet.
The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment says human health was the number one priority while creating the gray water regulation, and they wanted to minimize risk as much as possible. But states like Arizona and California have eased their regulations and now let people install laundry to landscape systems without a permit, as long as they follow best practices. That's one thing Avery Ellis, the ecological landscaper, would like to see happen in Colorado.
I certainly feel hopeful because I have a forum that people come to me and say, I want this. And people all around Colorado who want to see this adopted.
While the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment defends the current regulation, it's looking at possible ways to expand the use of gray water. It plans to hold community meetings soon. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Elizabeth Sakis in Denver.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.